Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. A new poll for Bucknell University finds that Americans' attitudes toward immigrants are changing and are more positive since the 2016 presidential election. The survey found pluralities of Americans think immigrants have a positive impact on economic growth and the culture of their local communities, but are more negative when it comes to employment and wages. Joining us to talk about this poll is Chris Ellis, professor of political science and director of Bucknell University Survey Research Laboratory. Professor Ellis, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a message or a question on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So Americans generally have more positive attitudes towards immigrants, according to this poll. Any reasons why?
Yeah, I mean, so since the election, I mean, we see this in policy areas other than immigration, right, that the American public tends to react against whatever the president's doing for whatever reason, right or wrong. And so part of it is that, and I think part of it is sort of a reaction to the rhetoric and in some cases the policy of the administration, right, that what we also found, and I'd like to get into this too, is that regardless of your feelings on immigration policy, most Americans have positive views of immigrants as people. And so to the extent that the rhetoric has focused on, you know, calling immigrants nasty names instead of talking about impacts on economic growth or wages or things like that, I think there's been sort of a backlash to that as well.
When you say that typically it goes against the rhetoric of the president in office, can you give us other examples? I don't know whether they're polls or maybe just anecdotal, but other examples where the public has kind of, I don't know, I won't say revolted because these numbers aren't revolutionary, put it that way, but do go opposite way that the president in office is going.
Yeah, so we can, the really good example of this is the Affordable Care Act. So Obama campaigned for a year saying that he was going to reform the healthcare system, did exactly what he said he was going to do, and then almost immediately the Affordable Care Act, on which he was largely elected, became unpopular, and then his party got destroyed in the 2010 elections right after it passed, right? So this was something that people said that they wanted, and once it was passed, it almost immediately became unpopular and didn't become popular again until Trump took office and promised to repeal it. So whether that's sort of a reaction against sort of ideological extremism or people just being schizophrenic, we sort of see this in all kinds of different ways. And we're seeing it, I think, here too.
What does it say about polls, then, if Americans, and this is a nationwide poll, by the way, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. What does it say, then, about Americans' attitudes towards some of these issues if they can be swayed that easily?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you sort of squint, there's kind of the public's actually paying attention and knows what's going on story here, in the sense that most Americans, despite, you know, how we all want to kill each other politically, most Americans are still in between the major political parties, right? We think Democrats are on balance too liberal and Republicans too conservative, so when parties start doing stuff, right, which includes keeping their promises, a lot of what we see is, okay, that's enough of that. We've had enough of that, and let's go the other direction. The analogy might be to a thermostat that's broken, right? If I want the room to be 70 degrees and it's set to 75, I turn it down to 70 because I want it to be cooler, and then it gets way too cold at 65. So then we try to turn it back up, and it gets too hot, and we're sort of trying to calibrate that way.
Dare we use the M word, moderate? Most people are moderate?
I think, I'm not sure if, I mean, moderate, I think, is a good word. I think most people sort of have opinions that are all over the map, right, that Republicans in office are conservative on everything, and Democrats in office are liberal on everything. But I think a lot of Americans sort of hold kind of a mix, right, that we might be pro-life but also want higher taxes on the rich, or we might want a pathway to citizenship but also don't like free trade. And so there's sort of, I think, a lot more either complexity or sort of, you know, just all over the mapness among people that we don't see among the people that we get to choose to elect.
So I want to get back to the poll and attitudes toward immigration. These numbers, and we'll talk about comparisons since the last survey you did on immigration in July 2016, which was actually before the November 2016 presidential election, but in the midst of it. But since then, immigration has been a huge topic of conversation, including DACA, immigrants who were brought to this country by their parents as children without documentation, the travel ban mostly from Muslim countries. When you hear that rhetoric, and I don't know, it sounds very angry at times over the past 2 years. This outcome in this poll may not have been predictable when you, I guess, what you hear from those extremes on television or on radio, in the newspaper. Any surprises here?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing there, and again, this is not just immigration, this is sort of American politics, the way it works now, is that the loudest voices aren't representative voices, right? And you mentioned cable news, but even, you know, people on Twitter or whatever, that the people who have the most to say don't always look like the American population. So when we see some of, like you said, the nasty rhetoric and things like that, I mean, there are people that believe that, and we found that too, but we find those sorts of attitudes don't trickle too far into the public, right? That even people who are sort of skeptical about increased immigration and skeptical of a pathway to citizenship still generally look at immigrants as being, you know, ambitious people, hardworking people, people that are trying to, you know, make a better life for themselves. And so, you know, I think there's certainly some of that rhetoric out there, and it tends to dominate the conversation. But from what we found, it doesn't seep too deep into the American population, and not even all that deep into Trump's base.
Yeah, let's follow up on that, because, you know, there have been so many analysis over the past year and a half of, you know, why Donald Trump was elected president. And, you know, you've heard about the white working class, that nobody was listening to in Washington, that it was only the people on the East Coast, Washington, New York, L.A., and the West Coast, that those voices were being heard. But another part of the explanation was that when the president, from the very beginning, when he announced his candidacy, talked about Mexican immigrants coming to the United States being rapist and talked about them being violent, that the analysis, some of them said that was one of the reasons that so many people voted for Donald Trump, is that they were anti-immigrant. You're saying that this poll showed that even Trump voters were not anti-immigrant as a block, correct?
Yeah, so we found that among Trump, people who said they voted for Trump, majority said that immigrants were hardworking, ambitious, and intelligent. So there is some positive stereotyping there. Now, Trump voters were significantly more likely than the rest of the population to say immigrants might be violent. But even then, we're only talking about half, or roughly a little bit less than half of Trump voters. So, I mean, I think, you know, trying to figure out what happened in the 2016 election is, you know, I mean, you can tell 10 different stories and they're all partially true. And I think there was, you know, some unease among Trump voters and the American public in general about what immigrants will do to the culture, whether it's going to sort of hurt American employment and things like that. But I'm skeptical of the degree to which those attitudes were grounded in just pure xenophobia or pure racism. I mean, undoubtedly they were for some. But I think if we're looking, you know, what we found, and not just our poll, but other polls, what we're sort of finding is when people say they're anti-immigration, that doesn't necessarily mean they're anti-immigrant. There's lots of other things that sort of go into that as well, like economic concerns or concerns about economic decline in communities and things like that. And all this stuff gets tied together. Now, it's, you know, I think the simplest story, and what maybe one of the reasons it's been sort of latched onto, is this sort of, you know, Trump voters are just motivated by hatred of foreigners thing. And certainly some, I imagine, were. But I think the story is significantly more complex than that.
And we're going to talk about some of the specific questions that were asked, or the results of those questions, a little bit later. What was the idea behind the poll?
What we wanted to do is just sort of take the temperature. So now, not just on immigration, but on some other issues, too. It's been 2 years since the election, and we're getting ready for midterms. And God, there's presidential candidates in Iowa already. And just to sort of get a sense of what's changed, right? Because we know that, you know, in poll after poll, most Trump voters say they don't regret their choice. We know he's reasonably unpopular, but his popularity has been sort of steady. So I wanted to sort of dig a little bit deeper behind those and just see, okay, is the American public want different stuff than they wanted a couple years ago? Are they sort of underlying attitudes that might, you know, affect how people vote or affect whether they vote in the midterm elections? Are those changing? And, you know, we see in the immigration poll, it's not a sea change, but again, a sort of more pro-immigrant point of view. We see people a little bit more skeptical of things like free trade since the election, maybe in part due to deteriorating or at least in certain communities, deteriorating economic conditions. But mostly we just wanted to get a temperature of sort of, if we look below do you like the president or not? What are Americans thinking and where are these attitudes coming from?
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest during this portion of the program is Chris Ellis, professor of political science and director of Bucknell University's Survey Research Laboratory. We're talking about a survey conducted for Bucknell about Americans' attitudes toward immigration, immigrants in particular. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We'll take some phone calls in just a moment. Wanted to get into some of the specific findings of the poll, though, Professor Ellis. There was a net positive result on economic growth, immigrants and economic growth. In what way? What did those who were surveyed have to say?
Yeah, so we found that a plurality, almost 50% of the country, say immigrants have a positive impact on economic growth. So basically, sort of looking at these results, I might divide them into how does immigration affect the country and how might it affect people like you. And so for the big picture indicators, things like economic growth, culture, impact on consumer prices, we find people are generally pretty positive. Right? At least plurality is saying that, look, immigration is doing good things for the country's overall economic health, for our culture, for what consumers have to pay for products. We find a little bit more skepticism when it comes to things like what is immigration going to do to your wages, or what is immigration going to do to the employment prospects of people that live around you. And that's where we find, not wholly negative views, but that's where we find people a little bit more skeptical about what immigration is going to do. But sort of these big picture things, like is it making the country healthier? Is it making us more vibrant culturally? People tend to sort of be reasonably positive about what immigration is doing.
So getting back to the question of economic growth, did you break it down? In what ways do those who were surveyed feel that immigrants contribute in a positive way to economic growth?
We didn't in this survey, but from others that we've done and other research out there, we find that people tend to see that immigration, if for no other reason, right, immigrants are doing jobs that Americans maybe don't want to do, right, strawberries would go unpicked and things like that. So we see people generally tend to think that immigration is one, adding economic activity that wouldn't otherwise be there, and is also making life a little bit easier for consumers, right, that if we've new people coming in and demand for labor goes down, though people aren't thinking in these terms, then prices are going to be cheaper, right? And we tend to see people look at economic growth that way, right? That it's better for consumers, we have more money to spend on other stuff we want to spend money on, and it's also sort of creating economic activity that wouldn't otherwise be here.
And so that was you anticipated one of my questions. I was going to ask about affordability, why the public said that immigration has a positive impact on affordability. So you're saying that because many immigrants are taking the jobs that many Americans don't want, that it keeps prices low. And obviously it's because they're not paid as much. That's part of it. So that's what they're looking at.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we see the same thing for trade, too, that people generally tend to recognize that free trade makes stuff cheaper, right, for slightly different reasons, but sort of the same class of reasons.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, what were you going to say?
And I was just saying, people sort of tend to realize that those kinds of economic benefits from things like trade and immigration, where they become more skeptical is, okay, what does this mean for me and my community?
There is some irony here, though, that even though the poll results show that most Americans who were surveyed said that immigration is a net positive on economic growth and keeps products affordable, that just this morning WITF had a story, we had a local story, and there also was the story on NPR about how so many people, employers in agriculture in particular, are having problems this year finding workers, that there are fewer immigrants taking those jobs. It has to do with some of the policies of the Trump administration, or at least the attitudes or the perceptions of those. So it's becoming a real problem here in South Central Pennsylvania and across the country.
Yeah, and we've seen that with things like slaughterhouses in the Midwest, right, that if the visas dry up, even the temporary worker visas, a lot of those jobs are just not going to get done, right? And that means fewer products on the market, and that means you know, less overall economic activity. Now, I don't think people are putting the pieces together quite that way, but sort of at least noticing, right, that you know, if these jobs are going unfilled and this work is getting undone, then that's eventually going to have an impact on what I can buy and how much I have to pay for it. That's a really good point, right? We've seen that, you know, certainly around here, but all over the country.
Let's take a phone call from Leon in Lancaster. Leon, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm actually going to pull off the road here and so I can talk with you.
Yeah, safety first. Safety first.
Generally speaking, can you hear me?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I think most Americans, if not all Americans, are in favor of immigration. We've had immigration grow the country. One of the things, though, immigration is a big tent word. And, in fact, when you break it apart, there's legal and illegal immigration. Secondly, I'm a business executive. I travel all over the world. Recently, I've been to Mexico. And when I went to Mexico, Chihuahua, I had to show my passport as I entered the country. Ironically, we had immigration Mexican agents come to the plant where I was at and look for our passports, which is kind of funny. I thought it was crazy. But having said that, most immigrants that I know are legal, and they've come, and they're higher-end skills. And what I see for some of the lower-end skills are great opportunities for automation and robotics, which are the future. And so we shouldn't depend on this cheap labor and totally open borders, which incidentally was one of the Clinton concepts. We should have a process where people come in legally, and we should welcome legal immigrants. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I look at it.
Hey, Leon, thank you very much for your call. And Professor Ellis, he makes a big point, and I'm curious whether that was something that was specifically asked in the survey, because he's right. If you ask people, just say the word immigration, most people would say, yeah, okay. But if you say illegal or undocumented and legal, well, then the attitudes kind of change.
Yeah. Now, we didn't ask about that here, but there have been lots of surveys that have. And you find a lot of this, right, that if you kind of dig into what people think about immigration, you get a lot of what was just said, right, that there's this idea that we tend to welcome immigrants, we tend to like them, even low-skilled ones we tend to think positively of. But there's this notion of fairness, right? And so the thing, you know, if you sort of ask people in an open-ended way about this question, one of the things that often comes up is, you know, why do certain people get to jump the line, right? And that's sort of the undocumented question. And so I think if you're sort of looking at what people are doing with this sort of stuff, I mean, certainly there's the legal-illegal distinction, but then there's also the concern that, you know, just because, you know, someone decided to come here illegally, why do they get precedence over people who are already here or waiting in line to try to follow the rules? So that we definitely see a lot of this, right? This notion that we need a system that welcomes immigrants, but it also needs to be fair. And what fair means, I have no idea. But certainly people are thinking about it in those kinds of ways.
Let's go to Marcus in Mechanicsburg. Marcus, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is for the gentleman is about voting, how the Trump voters, why they voted the way they did. Can you hear me?
Yes, sure.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Okay. Well, my question is a couple mornings ago, a young lady, maybe it was more than a couple mornings ago, but a young lady was talking about research that was done regarding why Trump voters, mainly the white population of the Trump voters, voted the way they did. And she suggested that what her research suggested was that they voted not because of individual problems, each person voting because of individual problems, but they looked around and tried and voted the way they did because they were worried about their status in society as a group. And that is very much related, according to her, to the immigration process and the amount of people who are coming from other countries, mainly Latinos, because that is a hot button issue. And how does the gentleman feel about why the Trump voters voted the way they did?
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. That's not something that's part of the survey, but you are a political science professor, Professor Ellis. The point that he made, and I'm familiar with the story he's talking about, that the research that Americans, especially white working class Americans, concerned about their status, their place in American society today.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that too. I think the study is well done. I also think there's a couple of problems with it. But in trying to figure out why Trump voters voted the way they did, I mean, so we should start with the simplest explanation, which is the vast majority voted for him because he was a Republican and they're Republicans and he happened to be the Republican on the ticket, right? And so, you know, we've seen 90% of partisans vote with their party going back to when Clinton was in office. And so a lot of the Trump voters are voting for him simply for pedestrian reasons, right? I want pro-life judges. I want taxes to go down. The people that are interesting, and I think the people that are sort of most referenced in the study you're referring to, are the people that switch, the ones that voted for Obama once or twice and then voted for Trump, because those are the ones that gave him his margin. And, you know, there's so many different explanations there. I mean, I think, you know, we shouldn't dismiss the cultural argument. I mean, I think, you know, the idea of declining status is an important one, right? That there's been sort of some, you know, particularly among evangelical voters, there's been this discussion that this is sort of like the last dying gasp before they become a minority in American society, and that, you know, that sort of, you know, resonated in some ways. There is the economic decline argument that it's not necessarily personal economic problems that someone's having, but looking around and seeing the factory going away in their community and things like that. And so that's part of it. And then, you know, there is the subset of the population, I personally don't think it's very big, but it was a close election, that really was sort of motivated by these kind of, you know, xenophobic messages and things like that, and sort of activated something in them that maybe Romney or McCain didn't, right? And, you know, I mean, there's been so much on this topic of what would make someone vote for Obama in 2012 and then switch in 2016. And, you know, I think a lot of it is just all of this stuff gets put together, right? And we really it's really difficult to disentangle, right? Because there's, for example, there's studies that show that, you know, people become more racist and skeptical of immigration when they feel economically threatened, right? So is that, you know, the economics doing it? Is that the racial attitudes doing it? And so there was just sort of this perfect storm of all of this stuff happening at once. So I think the gentleman's point is well taken, that a lot of this, or at least some of these people, were sort of saying, you know what, my status is going down, Trump is speaking directly to me, maybe he can preserve it, and let's go there. But if we're looking to see why, you know, almost half the country voted for Trump, let's just start with he happened to be the Republican that showed up on the ticket, and I'll hold my nose and do that.
So let's get back to the poll. You touched on this a little bit, but the results of the poll showed that Americans generally have a positive think that immigrants have a positive impact on the culture in their communities, which seems to say that they have embraced diversity.
Yeah, that was the one that surprised me the most, that we found that almost half of Americans said that immigrants were helping the culture in their community. And, you know, less than 30% said that they were hurting the culture in their community. Because if we're looking for a, you know, I don't like immigrants argument, you'd find it there, right? That there's something going on in my town that I don't like, right? And this was sort of Lou Barletta's shtick when he was mayor of Hazleton. But, yeah, we find that most people sort of think that immigrants are at least not hurting their local community in terms of cultural stuff. Now, again, they're more concerned about what's happening when it comes to wages and employment. But yeah, we found that people tend to be at least sort of neutral on whether immigrants are, you know, making a difference culturally around them, which I think is, you know, it's not necessarily an embrace of diversity, but it certainly is a tolerance of diversity, and maybe more than I was expecting.
The survey showed that they were less optimistic in areas of employment and wages. Again, seems to say that there's a concern there. There is a worry there that immigrants are taking jobs and that what they earn when they are here are keeping Americans' wages down.
Right, and this concern was particularly pronounced among people in what we might call the working class, right? People making less than, say, $50,000 a year. That's where we saw a lot of this concern. Now, economists are sort of split on whether that actually happens, right, whether immigrants sort of complement the labor that's already there, whether they're really in competition, it's probably a little of both. But people are certainly, I think, perceiving competition in ways that you know, may make sense given their economic status. But that's where people get a little bit more skeptical of what immigration is doing.
Some of the words used to describe immigrants by those who were surveyed: hardworking, ambitious, and intelligent. Hardworking was one that a lot of people, I mean, if I can recall, it was like over 70% said. But I do want to get back to something you had touched on earlier. 35% said a word they associate with immigrants is the word violent.
Yeah, so this is where we found the biggest partisan split. And if you're looking to sort of get back to, you know, what was Trump's base motivated by, maybe this is it. Because so take the hardworking, right? Almost 90% of Americans said immigrants were hardworking.
Okay, 90%.
And so that's huge. And over three-quarters of Republicans said that as well. So this was not like a significant partisan divide. Most people thought that. Most people thought that immigrants were ambitious. Most people thought that immigrants were intelligent. Where we found a bigger sort of political split was in this question of whether immigrants might be violent. A very few Democrats, less than or roughly one in five, said that this trait might describe immigrants. But about half of Republicans and Trump voters thought this. So if we're looking to see where Trump was sort of throwing red meat to the base, this is the line that might work, right? And if you notice his rhetoric about immigrants, it does not necessarily talk about immigrants sort of being, you know, coming over here and being lazy or whatever. You know, the immigrants are rapists, Mark, and the animals comment about MS-13 the other day. That really sort of plays into this violent stereotype. And so, you know, I don't know what polls he's reading or what strategies his consultants are coming up with. But when he talks about immigrants negatively, he almost always does it from this particular negative stereotype, not the sort of lazy or not intelligent things like that. And he goes straight to violence, and maybe that's if we're looking for a place where anti-immigrant rhetoric is working among his base, that might be where you go.
Just a couple more questions. Another partisan divide was on whether immigrants contribute more than they take. What did you find?
Yeah, so we found that in general, Americans, so the question was, do you think that immigrants contribute more to the country than they take from it? So basically, could pull everything together, is immigration a net positive? And we find that roughly half of Americans say yes, roughly a quarter say no, that immigrants are taking more than they're giving, and then some have no opinion. Most Democrats, something like 70%, thought that immigrants were contributing more than they're taking, and almost half of Republicans thought that immigrants were taking more than they're contributing. So, you know, again, these are not, you know, really strong numbers. I mean, we see Republicans and Democrats being bigger, have bigger differences on other issues. But yeah, sort of net-net, is immigration a positive, right? And this is where we sort of find more of a policy question than a stereotype question. And so if we're sort of looking at this, you know, one way you might think about it is, again, we're finding lots of people who sort of hold positive stereotypes of immigrants as people, nevertheless wanting less immigration. And so we might sort of look at this as one sort of indicator of why. That, you know, it's not that immigrants are bad people, it's not that we're scared of them, it's not that we think that they're somehow defective in some way. But if we look at all of the effects that they have on the United States, culturally, economically, wages, you know, what are we getting out of this? And that's where we start to see a little bit more of these partisan divides.
So
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish what you were going to say.
I mean, I think the sort of take home from this, I think is sort of heartening, is that what this sort of suggests to me is that, you know, again, despite the sort of extremist rhetoric that we hear or whatever, that if we look at what people are thinking about immigration, most, not all, but most are sort of looking at this from a policy perspective, not a, you know, are these people good or bad perspective. So the discussion may be a little bit more nuanced and more focused on policy than it is on just stereotypes, which I think is good.
A lot of good information to think about. Chris Ellis, professor of political science and director of Bucknell University's Survey Research Laboratory. Professor Ellis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. And I'm looking forward to that trip next May to London, Paris, Normandy. I think we'll have a good time. So if you're a history buff, World War II buff, just want to travel to Europe, think about that trip as well. Speaking of getting out of the studio and doing some traveling, this one's closer to home. Step into spring with a Smart Talk road trip to Nisley Vineyards. You can join me Thursday, May 24th at Nisley Vineyards in Bainbridge. We'll discuss Pennsylvania's wine industry and its impact on the state's economy and tourism. Plus, you can stick around after the show to explore the vineyard and enjoy a complimentary wine tasting. RSVP at WITF.org/events. Well, you may have heard there's a big wedding this weekend. No, we're not discussing that wedding, but the number one reason that couples seek marriage counseling, okay, I'm waiting for it. You're guessing right now. Probably isn't a difficult question to answer, but it's money. Joining us to talk about spouses, couples, especially newlyweds and finances, is Kim Kennewell-Hoffaker, a family wealth advisor and certified divorce financial analyst. Ms. Kennewell-Hoffaker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about spouses, about couples and money, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, no big surprise that money is the number one reason that couples disagree. Tell me about that. In what ways do they disagree?
Wow, that's a loaded question.
It really is.
They're going to disagree or agree on so many different topics. You know, from where are we going to live? What are we going to spend to live there? Are we going to rent or buy? Are we going to have a dog? Are we going to have a cat? Just small, little things that you would think to spend money on, and then large things. What's going to happen to the kids later? You know, what are we going to do to protect our family? How will life change when this wedding moves forward? And how will we direct our finances, direct our savings? How will we decide what to buy and when to buy it? How to buy it? The use of credit, the use of cash. There's just a number of topics that people that are going to get married need to address early on before the rings go on.
Do they, though? Do they talk about money? Because I have to admit that it seems as though so many couples focus on the wedding itself. They have a general idea of their spouse to be. And by the way, we're not talking just about newlyweds, but we'll be talking about those who are already married here in just a moment. But they have a general idea of the spouse-to-be's finances and financial background and what they're bringing to the relationship. But did they actually talk about it?
Well, one would hope that they have an understanding of what the spouse-to-be is bringing to the relationship. But more often than not, I'm not sure that conversation goes so deeply. More often than not, I think it's a brush topic because it's a really tough topic to talk about. It's really tough to get into the weeds on what the dollars and cents mean to your marriage. And I'm not so sure that they do talk about it. Couples that I've run into and that we counsel prior to marriage, they don't talk about half the things that we ask them questions about. And they're sitting there thinking, well, you know, I'm not so sure we ever discussed that.
Okay, well,
I didn't think about that.
What kind of questions?
So we all know the checklists. So we can go to our HR departments and we can get the checklists that are going to change our payroll taxes and our withholding and our benefits.
Things you have to do.
Yeah, things that you have to do. But maybe they don't understand the why they may have to do it. For a younger couple that's getting married, perhaps their parents were the people that they went to for advice and for decisions. And now maybe it's time to hand off those decisions to the next spouse. Even simple things that you and I might think about, like your power of attorney or your will or your medical directive, things that I don't think newlywed couples as a group necessarily think about in the forefront of their mind. And how does that dynamic play to their family, to the parents who may have had the power before? How does that conversation come around? And I think that it's just not something of top of mind.
Where do we, when we are entering marriage, learn to handle our finances?
Well, I guess most millennials today probably go to Google. but I'm not sure that that gives you that emotional or compassion component. I think that checklists are great, but I'm not sure that, that those types of black and white sites are going to give you the why. And I do advise people to sit down with advisors, wealth advisors, accountants, their attorneys, to have those conversations, even clergy and parents. There's a group of people that, that could be consulted with to have these beginning discussions that will morph and become much deeper over time.
I guess my question was more for what do people as they're growing up and become adults and get married, what do they observe? I would think that most of the time it's from their parents.
And parents don't always talk about money with their children. So,
so that's not the only talk that parents don't have with the kids.
No, there are a ton of talks that parents don't have with children.
Yeah, a lot of talks.
You know, I have children that come into our practice. Their parents send them in to have the budget conversation, to have the college is going to be this expensive conversation. Even children that need to be motivated to go find money for college and apply for scholarships, we're bringing them in to have those conversations because parents can't. And when you're dealing with teenagers and young 20-somethings, maybe the parents aren't being heard either. So even if the subject matter is coming up at home, maybe that that isn't going deep with the person receiving the information.
What's the biggest surprise that young couples have when it comes to money?
Dollars and cents just don't go as far as they think. And there are so many things to think about when you're becoming a couple and so many things that change. I watch couples look at what's in front of them today, but they don't stop to think what's coming in 5 years or in 10 years and how we need to plan today for those eventual expenses later.
Does age or first or second marriage or maybe third or fourth or fifth, if you're in Hollywood, do those things matter when it comes to money?
Absolutely. Okay. And I think multiple
Well,
marriages,
let's start with age. Let's start with age. And then go to multiple marriages.
So 20-something couples are probably starting careers and coming into their beginning salaries and their beginning earning capacities, and it's a different conversation than, let's say, a mid-40s to early 50s career-minded individual or couples coming into a marriage that may have money of their own, debt of their own, and that dynamic changes and the conversation changes. We're closer to retirement in our 40s and 50s than we are in 20s. So we look at different things. When you're coming into a marriage in your 20s, it may be a little easier from the standpoint of, for the most part, I would think that you don't have a bulk of your savings already created as you would in midlife. So there are a ton of things that change.
As far as a second marriage, third marriage, you have some experience under your belt, and probably money may have been one of the things that led to having ex-spouses.
Money is a huge component leading to ex-spouses, but it's also a huge emotional topic. And it's really hard not to argue about dollars and cents because it's one of the last things you do get to argue about when you're uncoupling, if you will. But going into a second or a third marriage, not only are you protecting what may have come out of the first marriage or you're protecting the assets that you were retaining, but now maybe there are other factors like children and finances for children. And what are your finances going into that second marriage going to protect? Are they going to protect your second spouse? Are they going to protect children that already existed? Or is it a matter of you have to protect everybody? And now the conversation morphs again because there are so many things to think about when you're entering a situation where you're in a multiple marriage.
You know, you hear about people who are fairly well-to-do entering into getting prenuptial agreements. Is that just for the very well-to-do?
Absolutely not.
Really?
Absolutely not. But when you're talking with first-time, when you're talking with couples who are going into their first marriages, it's very easy to be principled and say, I'm not walking into my marriage with a contract. And so I'm going to say 50-50. I'll have conversations where they're accepting of the idea, and then other conversations where it's completely not an option for them. That's not how they're contracting to go into their marriage. Are they protective? Sure. Can they be litigated at the end? Sure. And everything in between.
But who wants to think about the end?
Nobody.
That's right.
But 51% of marriages end in divorce.
Where'd you get that stat? Because I don't believe that stat.
Really?
Yes. I have seen figures because, I mean, you've heard that over the years that over half of marriages end in divorce. But my question has always been, starting when? And, you know, because I've actually seen figures to say it's closer to 40%.
I've seen figures that put it closer to 53 to 54%
in recent years. We're going to compare research then. All right. We'll get something out, an education for, because we strive for accuracy on this program. Let's go to the phone now. Dylan is in Harrisburg. Dylan, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Yes.
Let's see. I just wanted to start off by saying I am 27, due to get married in October, due to open a business here in Harrisburg within the next month. So I definitely understand like the struggles of money and how that can have an impact on your relationship. I just want to impress on people to really think of money as more of kind of an energy that flows, you know. You think about money in ways such as, you know, how am I going to pay my next bill? And then all you're going to end up doing then is worrying about paying your next bills. And there's a great book out there called The Energy of Money that really teaches people how to deal with money and how it affects our lives.
Hey, Dylan.
I just wanted to let everybody know about that.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. If money is energy, I should be asleep right now. but what do you have to say about what Dylan said?
So couples want to plan for their experiences. It can't all be about, I need to save for this, I need to save for that. Couples, ask especially newlywed couples, you have to have positive energy going into that. And if you have to have positive energy that lasts beyond the ceremony and all the stresses that come with the ceremony. So I do agree with what Dylan is saying, that it shouldn't be the root of all evil. It shouldn't be this really difficult topic for couples to come together on to have a conversation. And you want to promote positive conversation between engaged couples on what that future looks like. So I agree with him that it should not be the glass half empty. It should be a glass half full. And how do we together as this newlywed couple enjoy the fruits of our labor and enjoy each other?
Let's take a call from Pam in Harrisburg. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. We're an older couple. I own a house. My partner still has student loans, and right now she's not repaying them because she's not able to afford repaying, so she's deferred. If we get married, would that change her income, and would she have to start paying back? I also own a house, by the way.
If she is in an income-based repayment plan through her student loan company, it is very likely that her minimum payments could change. But she would need to consult the student loan company, the lender, to confirm whether or not that income-based payment will change with the marriage.
Very good.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. We have a question here, an email question. It's a simple one. Joint versus separate checking accounts.
Joint versus separate spending money. And it's another subject for conversation. This one is a little deeper. I believe that there should be some independence in every marriage. And there should be some expenses that husbands and wives don't need to consult each other on. So maybe there are joint checking accounts or joint save and separate checking accounts from which each spouse will work from for their own expenses, for things that they don't need to consult each other on.
Why? Why do you say that?
Why lose your independence? And why have to consult about every expense or every cup of coffee or every shopping trip that a spouse goes on. That might harbor resentment towards the other spouse. And that's not what you want with money. So, especially when you're coming in with two professionals, where they're probably used to doing their own thing, making their own decisions, and maybe not having to consult the other one. So, I think it's healthy to have a blend of both, depending on the circumstance. There may be one of the couples coming where one of the partners has debt or has bad credit, or there is a reason, a very financial reason, for keeping separate accounts and not putting monies together. But I think for a preponderance of couples getting ready to get married, it's a blend.
Okay, something you just mentioned, and I would guess that is one thing that a lot of people don't think about. The scenario you just described, one spouse does not have the best credit. I don't know how far it's gotten, but the other does. So they become a couple, they become one. I sound like I'm doing vows here. They become one. that has an impact on their credit rating, able to buy houses and cars and all that?
Well, the act of marriage doesn't necessarily have an impact on their credit rating.
Okay.
But what they may choose to do together that will affect their credit, like joint lending, like trying to get a mortgage or a joint credit card, how they as a couple use their credit, and for that I mean joint credit, that could significantly have an impact. When you may have one coming in, one side of the couple coming in with bad credit and one coming in with good, can the one with good help to rectify the one with bad? Or is this a situation where maybe the one with good credit is taking over the majority of the family finances while repairing the one that didn't have the best of credit?
Along the same lines, in many marriages, either husband, wife, or one of the partners controls the money as far as paying bills, that kind of thing. Good or bad thing?
My husband would tell you it's a bad thing. I'm telling you it's a great thing.
It's what this control person will do, right? I know we're getting a little personal now, but you know.
I think it depends on the couple. Sometimes it's a time constraint. One person has more time to handle the black and white finances and the transaction-based bill paying. But that doesn't mean the conversation shouldn't occur between both people in that marriage, especially for large expenses. But the repetitive payment of the credit cards that are due, or the student loans that are due, or the utilities that are coming due, that's a transaction. Mm-hmm. And that can be probably handled by either.
Let's take a call from Jim in West York. Jim, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes,
I've been listening with great interest to much of this. And my wife and I, we have a joint account that, hey, we know how much our bills are, and each paycheck we put money into the joint account. We still have our separate accounts. The one thing I would like all young people to understand out there is go home, get out your credit card bill, look at the amount of interest you're paying. I took a Dave Ramsey course, Financial Peace, went home, looked at how much I was paying in interest on my credit cards, my mortgage, and all I could think of was, think of all the fun I could have with this money I'm giving to other people. And, you know, if you've ever attended anything from Dave Ramsey, he says, pay cash. It's difficult to do, I know. But that would be my biggest thing to say to any newlyweds out there. Put a budget together. Stick with it. Don't live beyond your means. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you very much for your call. I could have had Jim as a guest on the program today.
And I would agree with the majority of what he said, which is pay cash, not racking up debt. However, in my world, debt isn't a bad thing. And couples need to be taught how to use credit wisely, because you don't want to not have credit, which could impact whether or not you get an auto loan or whether or not you can get a mortgage. We need couples to build credit, because you never know when you're going to have to lean there. It's not always a bad thing. Credit cards at 19%, bad thing.
We have a whole lot more to talk about. Kim Kennewell Hoffaker is a family wealth advisor and certified divorce financial analyst. We didn't get into the divorce angle. We had a question here, so maybe we'll talk about that in the future. Thank you very much for being on today's program.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday, we're going to be talking about, Alan Gelzo, written his latest history book.